Hello, listeners, and welcome to the Poetry Salon Cast. I am Tricia Faye Hefner.
And I'm Douglas Manuel.
On each episode, we interview one of our favorite poets to ask about their latest book.
What was difficult and what was easy about writing it.
And my favorite question, what do they do with a rough draft that wants to play rough?
If you want to hear more about the writers we interview and work with them in person, you can attend a live reading and workshop with them at the Poetry Salon.
Find out more and register for great workshops and events with us and our favorite poets at www.thepoetrysalon.com.
Now, without further ado, welcome to this week's episode of the Poetry Salon Cast.
So Ellen, whenever you're ready, take us away.
Hello, everybody. I'm Ellen Bass. I'm going to read two poems from my most recent book, Indigo, and the first one is the title poem, Indigo. As I'm walking on Westcliff Drive, a man runs toward me, pushing one of those jogging strollers with shock absorbers so the baby can keep sleeping, which this baby is. I can just get a glimpse of its almost translucent eyelids. The father is young, a jungle of indigo and carnelian, tattooed from knuckle to jaw, leafy vines and blossoms, saints and symbols. Thick wooden plugs pierce his lobes, and his sunglasses testify to the radiance haloed around him. I'm so jealous, as I often am. It's a kind of obsession. I want him to have been my child's father. I want to have married a man who wanted to be in a body, who wanted to live in it so much that he marked it up like a book, underlining, highlighting, writing in the margins, I was here. Not like my dead ex-husband, who was always fighting against the flesh, who sat for hours on his zafu chanting, Om, and then went out and broke his hand punching the car. I imagine when this galloping man gets home, he's going to want to have sex with his wife, who slept in late, and then he'll eat barbecued ribs and let the baby teethe on a bone while he drinks a dark beer. I can't stop wishing my daughter had had a father like that. I can't stop wishing I'd had that life. Oh, I know, it's a miracle to have a life, any life at all. It took 8 years for my parents to conceive me. First there was the war, and then just waiting. And my mother's bones so narrow, she had to be slit and I airlifted. That anyone is born, each precarious success from sperm and egg to zygote, embryo, infant is a wonder. And here I am alive, almost 70 years and nothing has killed me. Not the car I totaled running a stop sign or the spirochete that screwed into my blood. Not the tree that fell in the forest exactly where I was standing. My best friend shoving me backward, so I fell on my ass as it crashed. I'm alive, and I gave birth to a child. So she didn't get a father who'd sling her onto his shoulder, and so much else she didn't get. I've cried most of my life over that. And now there's everything that we can't talk about. We love, but cannot take too much of each other. Yet she is the one who, when I asked her to kill me, if I no longer had my mind, we were on our way into Ross, shopping for dresses. That's something she likes, and they all look adorable on her. She's the only one who didn't hesitate or refuse or waver or flinch. As we strode across the parking lot, she said, okay, but when's the cutoff? That's what I need to know. And I'm going to read one more poem, and that's the final poem in this book, Any Common Desolation. Can be enough to make you look up at the yellowed leaves of the apple tree, the few that survived the rains and frost, shot with late afternoon sun. They glow a deep orange gold against a blue so sheer a single bird would rip it like silk. You may have to break your heart, but it isn't nothing to know even one moment alive. The sound of an oar in an oarlock, or a ruminant animal tearing grass. The smell of grated ginger, the ruby neon of the liquor store sign, warm socks. You remember your mother, her precision a ceremony, as she gathered the white cotton, slipped it over your toes, drew up the heel, turned the cuff. A breath can uncoil as you walk across your own muddy yard, the Big Dipper pouring night down over you, and everything you dread, all you can't bear, dissolves, and like a needle slipped into your vein, that sudden rush of the world.
Ellen Bass, ladies and gentlemen, poets, writers, friends, I really want to say almost Ellen Bass is a poet who needs no introduction, but in case you've been living under a rock for several years, let me give her one anyways. Ellen Bass's most recent collection, Indigo, was published by Copper Canyon Press in 2020. Her other poetry books include Like a Beggar, The Human Line, and Mules of Love. Her poems appear frequently in The New Yorker, American Poetry Review, and many other journals. Among her awards are fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation, the NEA, and the California Arts Council, the Lombada Literary Award, and 3 Pushcart Prizes. She co-edited the first major anthology of women's poetry, No More Masks, and her nonfiction books include the groundbreaking The Courage to Heal, A Guide for Women Survivors of Sexual Abuse, and Free Your Mind, the book for gay, lesbian, and bisexual youth. A chancellor of the Academy of American Poets, Bass founded poetry workshops at Salinas Valley State Prison and the Santa Cruz, California jails, and teaches in the MFA program at Pacific University. Ellen Bass, welcome. I'm so honored and thrilled that you are here.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure.
In some ways, I feel like I've been talking with you for the last 3 days because I've been reading Indigo and, you know, taking notes and saying like, oh, I'm going to ask her about that. So thank you for being here in person to talk with me and Doug. I think you guys met at a conference recently. Is that correct?
Kind of. We did a virtual panel about form with the great poet Jason. I think I might get his name, last name wrong. Snyderman, I think it is. Did I get it correct?
Yeah,
did I
say Snyderman.
Right? Yeah, Snyderman. Yeah, no, Jason is significantly more of a formalist than Ellen and I would think. And he brought like so much more cultural capital. But then when we talked about purposeful lineation strategies and just thinking about like how we come to craft and our entryways into it, we are all speaking the same language. So I got so much from it. It was really, really like, I think nourishing. How about you, Ellen?
Oh yeah. I mean, that was, you know, a big part of why I wanted to be here is because I enjoyed that so much and I learned so much. And I think we kind of demystified a lot of yes. aspects. And I think that really talks to what you're saying, Doug, about finding how much we already knew, but hadn't quite put into a certain context, maybe, you know. But I mean, I've done a lot of conversations. We all have, I think, since the pandemic began. So it's great now to be in a new constellation and to get to all talk together.
I think Doug could talk about grass growing and it would be the most fun conversation I had in weeks. So let's talk a little bit about Indigo. Ellen, this is your 4th book of poetry, I believe. For me, I feel like I've been reading your work for 10 years now and getting more and more familiar with it. You know, could you say a little bit about when you knew it was a book, when you knew it was a collection?
Well, my approach is different from many people who have, I think the word project has become very much used. It never was for a long time, but now people do talk about book projects and poetry projects. And I have to admit, I envy those people because I would love a project. I'm a one person, I was going to say one person at a time person. I'm that too. I'm a one poem at a time person. Every time I write a poem, if it works out pretty well, I think, oh, maybe I could do something like this again, and I can't. So each one is its own thing, and I'm grateful for each one. I'm not a fast producer. I know I have a book by the simplest way possible, which is that I have a certain number of poems that are working at my personal best. So it's a numerical method, and it's only addition. And well, there's subtraction too. You take out the ones that aren't as good. I don't have books the way other people do, where these poems fit into this book, and then I'm going to save these poems because they're more like what happens in that book. There's a great quote from Pablo Picasso that I can't quote exactly, but it's something like, you know, the poor painter who can't put blondes and fruit in the same painting because he thinks they don't go together. And I, you know, I put everything that I want in my painting, and they just have to work it out and get along together. And I order them as best as I can so that they're not jarring. You know, you don't obviously put a really funny poem right after or right before a really sad poem. Give people a break to kind of make their transitions a little bit. And once in a while, I'll say, oh, well, this poem can't go in because there's just too many similar poems, or this poem just is too much of an outlier. But that is very little. Mostly the unifying factor is that they all came to fruition within a certain amount of time. But even that is misleading, because their genesis might have been 10 years before. So they're not necessarily from that time in my life in some sort of primal way. They're just from that time in my life in that that's when they were done, or as done as they were ever going to be. So I know that goes against most of what we're told about putting books together. But for those of you who don't have any better way to do it than mine, maybe this will be reassuring that you can do just put them together.
Yeah, absolutely. And you may have seen me, I don't know how obvious it was, but I think I rolled my eyes when you talked about the project, because I've been talking about that with my students, and I don't want to poo-poo it. I think project books are, they have their own special gifts that they give. But when you're trying to work on one, you know, they also have their own special hell that they invite you into. All artistic creation involves some frustration. And in terms of your book, Indigo, I mean, they all have your voice. They all live in that world. It's like, having read your other books first, I feel like I'm just picking up from where I left off before and just seeing chapter two, the continuation.
Yeah, no, it feels like the nexus is your body. And that's what I just really, really love about all of your work, because your poems are so deliberate, so precise, so concise. And like, you know, this is only the third time I've heard Indigo aloud, and it literally almost brings me to tears. And I think it's because of the specificity of the images. And again, that what the speaker decides to look at. So could you talk a little bit about that, as far as like when it gets to the craft of that individual poem? Because I think that's why the sequencing can happen so well, is because when your poems are revealing themselves from line to line, they're having that kind of deliberateness and specificity that calls to a real wisdom that I've always enjoyed with your work.
Oh, thank you, Doug. Indigo is an interesting poem. You know, in your email, you were talking to me, Tricia, about what were the easiest poems to write and what were the hardest poems to write. And it made me think, I wrote an email to somebody recently, and in the subject line, it said, quick question. And she wrote back, and there was actually a long answer, because it was more complicated than I had realized it was. And then she said, you know, maybe there's no quick question. And it really cracked me up. I mean, sometimes when you read ha-ha in an email, you don't really laugh, but it really cracked me up because I realized it was true. And then just when I looked at what poems were hardest and what poems were easiest to write, I realized those questions seem easy, but they actually are not. So Indigo, I wrote in less than a week. And I'd been trying to write for decades. So does that make it easy or hard?
You know, I love that you're saying that, because that's essentially why I started this podcast, is I really wanted to know, what is the mental process that you go through that allows you to access the poem, create the poem? I don't even quite know what terminology to say. Are we creating a poem? Are we pulling it out of air? Like, you know, the Plato's ideal form, it exists in an ideal form already, and we just have to find it and pull it out of the ether. So yeah, would you tell us a little bit about what process was like?
Yeah, so, you know, I'd been writing versions of this poem, versions like revisions, not, I mean, they never had the tattooed man in them, you know, I mean, they weren't this poem, but trying to grapple with this ex-husband and the impact of that marriage on our daughter and on my life. So I'd been writing poems, failed poems, for decades, pretty much none of which ever were published. I don't think I even sent them out anywhere. Not because I was holding back because of the material, but because they just weren't any good. So I'd been working up to this. It was definitely a situation where if at first you don't succeed, try again. And one day I was walking along West Cliff Drive, as I say, and I saw this man and everything clicked. And I don't know if I had a piece of paper in my pocket or if I ran home, but I wrote the outline of the poem, which is something I never do. The way the poem moves was clear to me. It was on a piece of paper about that big, not sentences or anything, just this, something like, you know, wrote on his body like a book, you know, I mean, just a couple of little things all the way down. And then in a couple of weeks, I was going to do a residency in Oregon at the Andrews Experimental Forest. And I knew I would have time there. And I decided not to try and write the poem until I got there so that I would have space and time and I wouldn't be rushing. And then in 2 days, I sat down and wrote the poem. I'm sure I polished up a little bit here and there and worked on the lineation, but I think I did most of it pretty much right there. And so it was, you know, maybe the hardest poem I've ever written and one of the easiest poems I've ever written.
That's wonderful. And part of what really struck me, the first poem I ever had published was called The Jungle Tattoo. And it was another one of those stories. First of all, topically very similar because it's about a man with a tattoo, but also like I probably spent a good 3 years trying to write this poem. And then one day someone said one thing, my mind relaxed. And in that moment of relaxation, like, bam, all of it comes out. I'm like, this is what the poem is really about. So that just resonated. And I think this is one of the really wonderful things about poetry is reading your poem made me think of my own obsession with tattoos in an additive way. The line about, I wish I had been with a man, married a man who really loved his body, you know, wanted to write on his body like a book. I was like, oh yes, that's also what I meant to think. You know, like I didn't think of it that way, But now that I'm hearing it, I'm like, yes, somewhere deep inside my head, I was thinking of it that way. I just didn't articulate it that way. Ellen Bass got into my head 10 years ago and articulated what I was trying to articulate. We get little boxes inside our own heads unlocked for us.
That book image was really what made the poem possible, when I could see that. And then describing the man, the stroller and the baby. It was a joy to try and describe him, and then a joy to imagine him. This is just a side note. I hoped that I would see this man again so that I could ask him if I could take his picture and have it on the book. And he must have been, I live in Santa Cruz, California, and it's a tourist town, and he must have been a tourist because I walk there pretty much every day, and I've never seen him before or after. So it was a one-shot thing, but I spent a lot of time looking for an image for the cover, and I really knew I wanted a tattooed man. And when I found this image in a book, an old book, then I couldn't find the photographer. And it was quite an involved process, and I finally did find the man. This beautiful man, many years later, this is an old picture of him. And he let me use the poem, and I couldn't find the photographer, but I could find the tattoo artist. And mm-hmm. they both live in England, very close to each other, just down the road. He said that I described him pretty well, except that they didn't have children.
I love that story so much. And I love that we're so locked in talking about imagery, because I was thinking, you know, again, going back to the specificity of your images, that it did feel like that these poems arise from a specific image. So from you to say that, like, the poem got its wheels and got started from seeing that, again, kind of reaffirms that. And so is that how it always starts for you, with a specific image or a carnal detail? I know you said that, you know, you're very deliberate and slow with your poems and you'll take them as they come. Is that how you usually get started? Or is it sound?
Not always. But the other poem I read, Any Common Desolation, does that too. Can be enough to make you look up at the yellowed leaves of the apple tree. And I'm describing those leaves. So that started absolutely with that image. I had been talking with a friend, and she's very visual, and she's a good decorator, and, you know, she knows how to put color together. And she said, the right two colors together can be as satisfying to me as an orgasm. And I had never heard anyone say anything like that. And I couldn't relate, but but I thought it was absolutely marvelous. So I was kind of seeing the world through her eyes at that moment, because it says, you know, they glow a deep orange gold against a blue so sheer. And so those two colors, you know,
working with those opposites. I love that.
For seeing, wow. You know, I was seeing through her eyes, which is just why we should sometimes talk to people, even if we're rather hermits in our lives, as I am, and very introverted. It's good to talk to somebody sometimes. That definitely started with an image, but I'm kind of looking through. Do they all start with images? Boy, an awful lot of them do. not all, though. I'm now seeing that there's some that don't. There's one called Marriage, and I guess it's an image in a way. When you finally, after long suffering, lay the length of your body on mine, isn't it like the strata of earth, the pressure of time on sand, mud? Maybe that's a kind of, that's an image. I guess they mostly do. Okay, here's one that is not an image. It's called Pearls, and it's about all the things I'm sorry for. I'm sorry I didn't buy my father the cashmere sweater with suede trim the summer I went to Europe. And I'm sorry I didn't stay longer with my mother after he died. Why was I in such a hurry to get back to my husband, who I only fought with anyway? So that doesn't start with an image. It starts with a concept. But I would say that mostly they do. we all have our strengths and our weaknesses, you know, the things that come more easily to us and the things that we have to work harder at. And my weaknesses are, I think, sound and music, you know, really getting the poem to sing. I have to really...
Those poems sing. Don't do yourself like that. Those
well,
poems
I have to
still
work
sing.
At that. I have to work at that. Thank you. That's not the part that just kind of comes. But metaphor and image, you know, metaphor is what I was born with. I mean, I don't always get a good metaphor, you know, every time I want one. But I think metaphorically. When I'm talking to people, I'm always saying, you know, it's like... You know, it's like this, it's kind of like that. When I'm arguing, I mean, metaphor is the way to argue because you can't argue with a metaphor. And at one point in our life together, my wife looked at me in the middle of a debate and said, "Everything you say sounds very right and logical, but I still don't agree." And it was like, she was like, "I'm not working on those terms anymore."
You know, one of the things I love so much about this book is the way you describe marriage. Oh, taking off the front of the house. That's a poem where you describe just a little domestic scene and thinking like, this should be a sitcom.
Yes.
You find yourself getting into those archetypal moments where you're just all like, I've seen this on a sitcom. But yeah, the poems are so very human. I did actually want to bring it back to the cover here and imagery. I knew when I saw the cover of this book, I thought there's no way that's the real man that she saw in Santa Cruz, that she was able to get him specifically. But I also, of course, didn't care. I just love the cover. And for those of you who are listening but haven't seen it, it's a cover of a man and his chest is almost free of tattoo, but his entire right arm is nothing but ink. And there's koi and waves of green and red and this giant purple flower and just swirls and swirls of things out of a beautiful jungle scene, I would say. And it's so lush and beautiful.
We'll get back to that interview in a moment. If you enjoy this podcast and want to learn more about us, log on to thepoetrysalon.com.
Most writers need a community around them to sustain their motivation and excitement for writing. The mission of the Poetry Salon is to provide inspiration, education, and support for poets everywhere at a price that is affordable.
Together, we are building a thriving community through online classes, e-courses, and readings, so you have the tools to live the life of a growing, prolific, accountable writer.
You also get opportunities to share your work and receive supportive feedback, then turn your finished pieces into journal submissions, building an audience for your writing.
Again, visit thepoetrysalon.com to find out more and register today.
I am the kind of poet that almost everything begins with an image, but I love to hear that you have to work towards the musicality. Could you talk a little bit about what that process is like? You know, do you have a book that you turn to help you understand how to write more musically? Or do you play music? What do you do to get more into the musicality?
I think I do a number of things. I study and read and study poems that have gorgeous sound in them and really try to see what it is they're doing, how they're doing it. I think teaching helps me because we're always taking apart poems and really looking at the craft of them closely. I've been doing this series online craft talks called Living Room Craft Talks. I started it at the beginning of the pandemic and I focus on some element of the craft each time. And I loved teaching the one where I focus on music, really being able to take apart the poem. That part's really fun. And sometimes I do things very deliberately. It's not in this book, but I have a poem called What Did I Love that is about slaughtering chickens. And it goes step by step through that process.
Tricia, can she read it? I love that one. You read that one when we did the formalist talk. I love that one. Is that okay, Tricia? Is that okay?
Do you think that I'm going to say no? I mean, Ellen, if you want to, please, by all means.
Sure. I'll read this poem. Maybe before I read it to you, I don't know that you'll be able to hear it. As you'll hear, it goes through a process. It's a brutal process. And I realized when I wanted to tackle writing this poem that I was going to need to do something to work against the tendency of a poem like this to sound like a cookbook, an instruction manual. First you do this, then you do this, then you do this, then you do this. So I knew that I had to work with music really, really consciously from the beginning. I had read Dorianne Lux some years before, had written some short poems in a form that I think she invented, where the end word of each line ended with a certain consonant. There was one called Men, and the end lines all ended with the F sound. You know, it's tough to be a man, it's rough. And the last line was alone at the end of a wharf. And I thought that was really, really fascinating. She did one about Emily Dickinson hearing the fly buzz, and all the N sounds were the Z sounds. And I tried to imitate that in a longer poem in which all the N sounds had N's in them. And I worked and worked at that poem, but it just didn't work. I believe that everything that we work at in poetry is useful, that nothing is wasted. Whether the poem fails or not, it isn't wasted. And you might not know what you're practicing for, but you're practicing for some future poem. And sometimes you can actually trace the genealogy. And with this poem, I could trace that genealogy back to this failed poem where I worked at for quite some months and couldn't bring it through. But this idea of the end consonant really stayed with me. And so when I wrote this poem, I picked R, the R sound. And I also, because I picked it partly because R is a softer sound and the poem is so harsh, but also because it's a common sound. Like I wasn't going to pick the F sound, you know, that was just going to be way too hard. And then I gave myself more leeway that the end word didn't have to end with an R, but it had to have an R in it. And then I would thread a lot of R's through the poem. So that gave me a certain amount of music to work with and some way that musically it could hold more together. And then, of course, I worked with the images and the metaphors and all of that. But you'll hear a lot of R's. What did I love? What did I love about killing the chickens? Let me start with the drive to the farm as darkness was sinking back into the earth, the road damp and shining like the snail's silver ribbon and the orchard with its bony branches. I loved the yellow rubber aprons and the way Janet knotted my broken strap and the stainless steel altars we bleached, Brian sharpening the knives, testing the edge on his thumbnail, all 88 Cornish hens huddled in their crates, wrapping my palms around their white wings, lowering them into the tapered urn. Some seemed unwitting as the world narrowed. Some cackled and fluttered, some struggled. I gathered each one, tucked her bright feet, drew her head through the kill cone's sharp collar, her keratin beak and the rumpled red vascular comb that once kept her cool as she pecked in her mansion of grass. I didn't look into those stone eyes. I didn't ask forgiveness. I slid the blade between the feathers and made quick crescent cuts, severing the arteries just under the jaw, blood like liquor pouring out of the bottle. When I see the nub of heart later, it's hard to believe such a small star could flare like that. I lifted each body, bathing it in heated water until the scaly membrane of the shanks sloughed off under my thumb. And after they were tossed in the large plucking drum, I loved the newly naked birds, sundering the heads and feet neatly at the joints, a poor man's riches for golden stock, slitting a fissure, reaching into the chamber, freeing the organs, the spill of intestines, blue-tinged gizzard, the small purses of lungs, the royal hearts, easing the floppy liver carefully from the green gallbladder, its bitter bile, and the fascia unfurling like a transparent fan. When I tug the esophagus down through the neck, I love the suck and release as it lets go, then slicing off the anus with its gray pearl of shit. Over and over, my hands explore each cave, learning to see with my fingertips, like a traveler in a foreign country, entering church after church. In every one, the same figures of the Madonna, Christ on the cross, which I'd always thought was gore, until Marie said to her it was tender, the most tender image. Every saint and political prisoner, every jailed poet and burning monk. But though I have all the time in the world to think thoughts like this, I don't. I'm empty as I rinse each carcass, and this is what I love most. It's like when the refrigerator turns off and you hear the silence. As the sun rose higher, we shed our sweatshirts and move the coolers into the shade. But other than that, no time passed. I didn't get hungry. I didn't want to stop. I was breathing from some bright reserve. We twisted each pullet into plastic, iced and loaded them in the cars. I loved the truth, even in just this one thing, looking straight at the terrible, one-sided accord we make with the living of this world. At the end, we scoured the tables, hosed the dried blood, the stain blossoming through the water.
Oh, wow. I am so grateful that you read that and told us the story of the genesis of that poem. It's funny because I've heard that poem many times and I've never thought about the repeating R sound.
Of course not. No, no one possibly could. And I did, after I wrote the poem, change a few of the line breaks. And so some of the lines don't end with R anymore, even though they once did, because the line breaks were just a little too wonky. So, you know, the important thing wasn't ultimately being true to a four. It wasn't an assignment, you know, that you get extra credit for having an R. You know, you're allowed to make the poem what the poem wants to be, you know. So some of the lines now don't end with R, but most of them do. And there's so many R's and some words I'm sure I would not have come up with. And that's another part of the music. I don't think I would have come up with sundering, but I love that word. Sundering is such a beautiful word. I had lists. I am so sorry I didn't keep these. I had pages and pages and pages of words that had an R in them. I mean, that's a lot of words. You wouldn't think you'd need to make a list. You wouldn't think that you couldn't just think up words with R in them because they're all over. But there was something about that process that was very helpful to me in just, you know, I'd read the newspaper, I would be watching TV, and I'd just be making, oh, that's an interesting R word. That's a good R word. I like that R word. And I just had them all over the place.
I was going to get at something that we talked about a lot in the formal video that we did, Ellen, about like how restrictions actually sometimes give us freedom or end up kind of being gateways into something else. And so I think this poem ends up really being an example of that. So besides finding that great word sunder, what other kind of discoveries and beauty was found in this through having that restriction of the R sound?
I think that it gave me primarily the thing that I said first was a way to get out of the overly prosaic of we did this and we did that, and really get my mind wrapped around sound. Part of my mind was allowed and encouraged to just be thinking about sound. I think that was really important that I had that from the get-go so that I could work with the images, but I could also be very, very aware of sound. And I think that there's something when you've got something to do that is mechanical, I'm always trying to distract my overly logical mind. I believe that poets are on a continuum from the ones who are super logical and the ones that are super into sound or imagination or surreal. Then there's ones in the middle of that bell curve who are very evenly balanced. But whatever end you're at, I think it's important to try and work toward the other end. And so I'm overly logical. I have to work toward the things that will take me off of that overly logical course. And sound is one of them. And it's kind of like, you know, if you give the child something to do so the grown-ups can talk. But in this case, the child is the logical mind. You know, give her...
There's those metaphors.
There's the metaphors, right?
And it's reminding me of the four temperaments from Gregory Orr, right? That you want to lean into the limitless side instead of the limit side.
Exactly. Yes. That's nice to be reminded of that. Thanks, Doug.
You know, something else that I think is super useful about this discussion too, is I work with a lot of new poets who start out with rhyme, and I never want to tell them, you know, I hate to tell you, but no one rhymes anymore. We don't like it. We've had enough of it. Stop. Because I know that's what they like. They're really interested in the musicality. So what I've tried to do is say, like, oh, I can understand you really like rhyme. You've got an ear for music. You approach it from the musicality. Have you thought about using more subtle techniques? Like I told someone the other day about internal rhyme. And he's like, I've never heard of that before. And I thought, great, I can give you that tool and you can still rhyme, but make things more subtle with it.
There is a lot of writing in traditional forms now that is exciting and fascinating. In the next series of craft talks that I'm preparing now, one of the weeks is going to be on the sonnet. And although there are a lot of untraditional sonnets being written now without rhyme, there are so many amazing rhymed sonnets. I mentioned Dorianne Lux earlier, and she's got an amazing poem in her new book called Death of the Mother, in which she uses the end rhymes from John Donne's Holy Sonnet number 7 as the end rhymes for her poem. I really encourage people to read it. It's from her new book, New and Selected, Only as the Day is Long. And then I think about Patricia Smith and all the rhyming that she does. Oh my God. Yeah, exactly. She is the heavy lifter of rhyme and crown sonnets. It's true that beginning poets who are kind of clanging their rhymes together have a lot of craft to learn yet. Mm-hmm. But I don't write in any rhymed traditional forms at all, but I was excited just to see how much is out there. I was even only looking in the form of the sonnet for that. I've done five series. How do you say the plural of series?
Would you say series?
I have no idea. Series? Baby, what's the plural of series? My wife usually knows these kind of things. Let's see if she'll find. She says series.
I think that's right. And that's a fabulous line. Baby, what's the plural of series?
Oh, no, we all should write a poem of that, right? Now we're all going to write a poem, baby, that, first line. What's the plural of series?
I think it's just such a great line.
No, challenge accepted. I think all three of us have to write that poem and then send it to each other. That's amazing.
Okay. Well, I have done five of these series in the past, and each series is 6 weeks, and I'm going to be doing a new one in October. I'll be talking about metaphor, the elegy, silences in poems, and the epistolary poem, the elegy, and transforming trauma into art. But when I talk about these topics, those are just sort of the topics. I also talk about syntax and diction and music and image and everything else. So
where do we get the links?
Go to my website. My website is ellenbass.com, so it's not hard to remember. By next month, the new series will be up, but you can also see the old series. You can also see the old series 1 to 5 that's on the website now. They are reasonably priced, but there are scholarships, and all you have to do is say you want one. Just say you need one and you get one.
That's very generous, Ellen. Thank you so much. And I will say, I know one of my students took you up on that, and she had nothing but good things to say. In fact, I think I have several of my students who told me, sorry, I can't make it on Friday. I'm doing Ellen Bass's workshop. So I feel like I've learned a lot about what you teach through the discussions I have with them.
That's wonderful. That's great to hear.
I'm always learning so much from you by reading your work. I know we're getting close here, but before we go about our day, I did want to ask a little bit more about the poem that came more easily to you.
This poem came, Any Common Desolation, came very easily, except, and this is why that kind of what comes easy and what comes hard is so difficult, I couldn't get the ending. I just couldn't get the ending. And the ending now is the Big Dipper pouring night down over you, and everything you dread, all you can't bear, dissolves. And then here comes the ending, like a needle slipped into your vein, that sudden rush of the world. So I had, as the world enters, like a needle slipped into your vein. Well, that's terrible, because you're ending with a needle in your vein. I mean, that's not right. But, and then I had, as the world enters, insistent, instant as a needle in your vein, which isn't very good either. I had, as the world enters, liquid, insistent, as though it's been shot through a needle into your vein. I had, as the world liquid, insistent, shoots through a needle into your vein. Then I was trying to get done with vein, and I had, and like a needle slipped into your vein, the lit world enters. And at least that was better, because I was off of the vein and into enters. But then finally I got, and like a needle slipped into your vein, that sudden rush of the world, so that we could end with the rush of the world. But that was hard and took a long, long time and a lot of mashing my pen into the page and trying. I actually got a little help on that ending from my poet pal, Frank X. Gaspar, who I was sending these back and back and back and forth to. And he came up with rush.
Mm.
And that's why we need friends.
Oh, absolutely. And of course, I have my own agenda for saying this, but I mean, that's why workshops are so crucial. We're always learning from each other.
Always, always.
I did want to also tell you, since you brought up the what I loved about the chickens, killing the chickens, I think your poems are so human and so relatable. And often when I'm reading your work, I frequently will find a poem that I go, oh, well, I got to write a poem like that, or that relates to something in my life. So let me get out my paper now and I'll write a poem, you know? And I just think your poems
help
generate other poems.
Thank you. And that's the best. I mean, that is just such a wonderful feeling. You know, whenever I feel stuck, you start reading poems and you want to talk back to them. You want to be in conversation with them, because we are in one big conversation. I think it's Marie Howe who says we're all writing the same poem.
And I'd also say it gives us a way to talk about things that might be difficult to talk about. So the poem I just referenced, I really had a person broke into our house while I was there in the house and stole my purse and my backpack in front of me, or he tried to steal my backpack. I actually grabbed my backpack out of his hands because I startled him, but then he grabbed my purse and ran down the street. And, you know, I didn't want to talk about that. It was hard and I didn't want to talk about it. But then I was in a workshop and I think I brought that poem in or something. And I was looking at that line, "What did I love about killing the chickens?" And I just thought, yeah, what do I love? You're just expecting something beautiful. What do I love about picking flowers? What do I love about eating ice cream? And then to get to kill the chickens. Oh, that's so harsh. That's so different from what I'm expecting. How could I finish that sentence? What do I love? What's the thing I absolutely did not love and wouldn't want to do again? Oh, that break-in. That's great. And so I was able to write that poem. And it actually ends with me thinking, like, you know, the man could have killed me, but instead he didn't. He ran away because he was afraid of me. Mm. And that kind of helped me reclaim my power a little
bit.
I never would have talked about that. I never would have written a poem about that, except that I had that line that really jarred it out of my little hiding box where I was writing it.
Thank you so much for sharing that with me.
Yeah.
And that's beautiful what you say about the way you discovered some very important essence of that experience through the poem, because that's why we write. We want to be changed. Mm-hmm. We want to be transformed. I mean, I do write poems in which I can't say that I'm very significantly changed or transformed, but the ones that are the most important, I am. They absolutely do. You know, we talk about some of these things, and then when they happen, we go, well, it really does work the way we keep saying it works. But they are transformative. You know, I'm not the same after writing Indigo. In subtle ways, I can see how my poems have changed me. And then, of course, when we read poems, we're changed. I mean, that's what we want to have happen for the reader as well. And some of them are touchstones. And in hard times, we try and call them up and remember them, because they give us a way to hold our experience. They give us a way to have the strength for our experience, or the patience or the resilience or whatever it is that we need. I mean, there are poets who I quote to myself all the time. And maybe I'll just make a last pitch for, you know, I know we have to end soon, but for learning poems by heart.
Yes.
So that you have them when you need them. And how much you learn about the poem when you learn it by heart. And if you're intimidated by this, there's a fabulous book that will talk you through it. It's by Kim Rosen and it's called Saved by a Poem.
I was just going to say, you know what? Can I make a pitch for fabulous. Kim Rosen?
And you should read the whole book, but what you really need to know is the method. And the method is just learn one line. Just learn the first line and don't go on. Don't go on until you're completely comfortable with the first line. And that way there's no stress. If the first line takes you a week, a month, 6 months, it doesn't matter. Just learn the first line, because, you know, you can see that I am not young. In fact, I'm having my 75th birthday this week.
And happy birthday! Yay! Gemini energy all day. I totally can feel that Gemini energy.
Thank you. And, you know, the memory thing is real. I forgot my phone number recently when I was checking into a hotel and I was so embarrassed. Fortunately, my wife was there and she rescued me. I forget the last names of friends that I know well. I mean, I just forget all kinds of things. And if you're in that situation or you feel like you don't have a good memory, you can do it through this method. My wife and I just learned Natalie Diaz's Ode to the Beloved's Hips, which is 2.5 pages long and has a lot of Spanish in it, which I don't speak, and amazing words in it that are uncommon. I mean, it's not an easy poem to learn. And for some reason, she got it into her head that she was going to learn it because she needed more joy, she said, in her life. And it's a very, very joyous poem. And I said, well, can I learn it with you? Can I do it too?
And she's, I have so hard of couple envy for you guys right now. Y'all memorizing poems. My wife and I need to step our game up.
Start with a love poem. Yes, we are. Seriously. Start with a love poem. It really is just one of the richest things to do. And we both learned it. It took us about 6 weeks. We were so surprised we learned it so fast. Janet, my wife, kept saying, I don't think I can learn this whole poem. And I said, you know, look, you know, we're just going to do like Kim Rosen, you know, what if we only learn 6 lines and that's all we ever learn? We'll have 6 lines more than if we didn't learn them. Let's just like take all the pressure off. And as it turned out, we learned the whole poem and it only took about 6 weeks.
That's incredible. Could I ask your favorite, most significant poems that you've learned by heart?
Well, the first poem I ever learned by heart is Marie Howe's What the Living Do. When I thought, okay, I'm going to learn a poem, I thought, you know, what poem is kind of worthy of being my first learned poem? And then I learned a very short poem by Jane Hirschfield, Love in August. I learned W.S. Merwin's poem, West Wall, which is a beautiful love poem. And when my wife and I finally had a wedding ceremony after many decades and children together, I said that poem to her as my part of our ceremony. And I think there's a couple others along the way. I haven't learned a lot of them. Each one is a treasure.
Yeah, that's such a gift to get those recommendations. So thank you for that.
Different things come out when you learn a poem. With Jane Hirschfield's poem, I was co-teaching a workshop with Kim Rosen. We were each doing in the workshop kind of the thing that we do. And, you know, so I was kind of teaching the writing of poems and she was teaching what happens when we learn a poem by heart and when we speak it to others. Part of what she does in her workshops is she pairs people up and they say the poem back and forth to each other. And you do it over and over. And I was paired up with Kim. And I said, Love in August, and started sobbing as I said the poem. It's a very short poem. I must have said it like 10 or 12 times the first day. And each time I cried, each time crying, because it touched something that was, you know, had been going on in my life, a really hard time that I was kind of coming out of. And the poem for me was kind of about that. But I had read the poem many times and never cried. Mm. It was only when I learned it and said it. And I think that what is significant about that is what it is kind of a real testimony to the depth of emotion that happens when we have the poem in our bodies.
That's exactly what I was going to say, but you got there, of course. Like, it shows that the poem is a corporeal experience, you know, through form, through lineation, I'm controlling the physical experience of the poem in your body, and memorizing it and taking it in as a vessel, it makes you do that at a higher level. Like, that story kills me. I only have like 3 poems to memorize, and now I think I need like 17.
Doug, I have to ask you, what are those 3?
Those Winter Sundays, We Real Cool. And then, oh my goodness, I used to be able to do In Love and War by Warshenshire.
That one I might have memorized accidentally just because I've read it so many times.
And I got that from Kim Adenizio's book, Ordinary Genius. You teach it too, yes. Tricia. We talk about it a lot. And yeah, she talks about the importance of memorizing a poem. And so that was the one I did. I cannot tell you guys how many times the line, Sundays too, my father got up early, comes to me. Like, I'll just be walking and I'll just be like, Sundays too, my father got up early.
This has been wonderful. I love what you guys both just said about carrying poetry in the body. And going back again, Ellen, to your poem Indigo and that line about, I wish I had married a man who loved his body and loved decorating it with tattoos. That just really touched me because I also pretty much in my head all the time. And so when I read that line, your line from Indigo, I was just like, yes, that is why I'm obsessed with tattoos and people who can have tattoos. I want to have a body. I want to be aware of it. I want to go enjoy Sunday afternoon barbecues. I'd be eating vegetarian barbecue, but you know, same thing. I mean, I feel very inspired now to go and start taking more poems into my body. Oh. And yeah. And of course, I have to also give credit again to Kim Rosen, her book, Saved by a Poem. And Ellen Bass has her wonderful series, plural, of living room lectures. Ellen, one more time, could you give us the website where people can find
that? Yes, the website is just ellenbass.com. Right now, the new series of the fall isn't quite up yet. It'll be up in July, but you can see the past series, and they're not interactive other than a small Q&A at the end. So a lot of people don't actually attend live. They just watch the recordings at the time that's convenient for them. And so you don't miss anything if it's already happened.
Also, get a number of Ellen Bass's books. The most recent one is Indigo. This was such a pleasure to read, and I'm looking forward to seeing the return to Ellen Bass world when it next comes out.
Thanks so
happy
much.
Happy birthday, thanks, Ellen, next week. Oh, happy birthday.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to talk with you both. Always a pleasure.
Do you want to do a random act of kindness? How about a senseless act of beauty? Please rate and review us and write a comment on this episode.
It helps us get heard, get seen, and it helps other poets find us in the chaotic distractions of cyberspace.
Are you a poet who wants to be interviewed on the Poetry Salon cast? Contact Trisha@thepoetrysalon.com and send some of your work to be considered.
And don't forget that this writer will be teaching a guest workshop on the last Sunday of this month at 2 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. To purchase tickets, write to Trisha@thepoetrysalon.com.
Thanks again for being part of our community. And whoever writes the worst draft wins!
Yay!